When the shift boss hits that button, then you'd better look alive, 'cause the lumber comes a-rolling like the bees out of a hive. And you'll feel that sweat come pouring as each muscle screams with pain, and you'll wonder if it's worth it working on the long green chain.
Hi, I'm Mark Laren Young, and welcome back to the Green Chain Podcast. What is wild foresting? It's a new and ancient approach to forestry explored in the book Wild Foresting, Practicing Nature's Wisdom, edited by Alan Drankson and Duncan Taylor. Their book explores concepts ranging from ecophobia to eco-psychology. The three of us met to talk eco-concepts at Drankson's kitchen table in Victoria, BC, in a house surrounded by a diverse collection of beautiful trees.
How did you both become passionate about forestry? How did you both get involved?
My first real interest in trees began when I was a teenager. We acquired a farm on Georgian Bay in Ontario, and we decided to put in apples, and we put in 2,000 apple trees, Macintosh, Northern Spy, and Delicious. And I was the chief orchard person, and that got me interested in not only trees, but also in organics, and what could we do to have some of the acreage put into organic apples. I then came out to British Columbia, and my brother, Graham, my older brother, was a paramedic working at the Wass Camp, McMillan-Bodell Camp, north of the Gold River. And I ended up going up there for visits. And I was curious. One day, one of the fallers was going around with a camera, and he was taking pictures of trees. And I said, "Why are you taking pictures of trees?" He said, "Don't get me wrong, I love trees, but I'm going to be cutting these down. Someone's got to do this." And that got me very interested in the values of, you know, protecting forests versus jobs. I later went on and began to investigate and write about sustainable forest communities. And during that period, I met Alan, and we began to collaborate on ways of how do you protect intact forest ecosystems and at the same time protect communities that derive their sustenance from those forest ecosystems.
Well, my passion for trees and forests goes back to my childhood, of course. I was born on the prairie, and the trees that we had nearby were either in the stream bottoms and were mostly hardwoods, and willows and box maple and things like that, or they were stands of trees that were about four species planted by the homesteaders. And by the time I was a child and living in those areas, these trees had gotten fairly big. And so we used to play in them all the time. You know, we used to climb around in trees just like little squirrels. And from that time on, I've always had a love of trees. And then when we moved out here, the forest, the conifer forest, became my second home. So we were living close to unlogged conifer forests that are actually, you know, when I think back about it, they had all kinds of different species in there. But to us coming from the prairies, the fact that there were so many big conifers stood out. And so a lot of times I would spend out in the woods by myself for hours climbing in the trees and sitting in little openings, and, you know, had like nest areas, and we built little huts and things like that. So that was, you know, from that early beginning, then as I became a mountain climber and hiker and skier and outdoor person, which I'd always been anyway, because my whole family tradition on one side goes back that way, back to Norway. We, you know, gradually you get to know more and more about the incredible beauty of the intact wild forests and you develop a love and passion for them, and it's an easy logical step to caring for them to the degree that you become social activist. And so by the time I came to Victoria, which was 1968, I was already a social activist with respect to environmental philosophy and issues and so on.
And you said you worked in the forest.
And I worked in the forest, yeah. When I was in high school and going to college, I grew up on the coast here in logging communities, and so we had, everything from large-scale logging conducted by big companies like Weyerhaeuser and Simpson, McMillan, Bodell, and so on. And these companies, were pretty uniform all up and down the coast from Northern California up to Alaska. They were interconnected in various ways. And in fact, I knew a lot of the people who were members of families that owned some of these companies. At the same time, we worked in the woods and we worked in the sawmills, because that's where you could get a summer job. And even a paper mill, I worked in one of those for a while. Fiberboard plants.
And what were the jobs you did?
Pardon?
What were the jobs you did in the forest?
Well, everything from off-bearing a head saw, which is incredibly dangerous, noisy work, feeding the hog the big slabs of bark that they didn't want to use in those days, so they all went into the chipper, to straightening out the enormous timbers that came off the head saw so that they could be sorted and sent back to the resaw, and so on. Then that whole chain fed the green chain, and the green chain was an initial sort, and then they sent the stuff through planers, and that's when they got the final dimensional lumber. And that stuff was stacked, and packaged for either going in the kiln or going out as green lumber. And in the different plants, most of the jobs were very repetitious jobs, but they weren't as heavy, and they were dustier than a sawmill, like fireboard plant, where they made these acoustical tiles. Well, I worked on a number of jobs there, but most of the time I was inspecting the acoustical tiles coming off of the press that drilled holes in them.
Yeah. I think I mentioned that my experiences in the orchards in Ontario got me interested in not only environmental issues, but also issues connected with communities, with farming. When I came out to British Columbia, one of the first things I did was I began to take people up to Merv Wilkinson's wildwood. And that became a prerequisite for all of the introductory classes in environmental studies, that we would all go up to visit wildwood and hear Merv Wilkinson. And the students were absolutely enchanted with not only wildwood, and the experiencing of being on a site which has been able to retain over the years the spectrum of forest values, but also by Merv Wilkinson and his stories going back to the late 30s and early 1940s.
Now, can you just sort of set the scene for people who don't know who Merv Wilkinson is and what wildwood is? Because I'm aware of it, but somebody who's listening might not. Okay, the scoop.
Yeah, and Merv Wilkinson has just celebrated his 95th birthday, and this was in just this past September. Merv Wilkinson has had a piece of property just south of Nanaimo on Vancouver Island. It's approximately, I think, 137 acres. It's relatively small, but he has been able to maintain, actually, the values of the forest. In other words, the overall, not only in terms of biodiversity values, but in terms of the, it's an uneven aged forest. It has old growth in it. It has multiple species, multiple ages. He's been able to do that consistently since the late 1930s and have it on a sustainable basis. In other words, he will only log the amount that grows on a yearly basis. But what he's been able to do has received international acclaim. He's had programs, the BBC, the CBC, David Suzuki. And it's become a model, as it were, for the type of ecoforestry that we then began to try to disseminate in the 1990s.
Now, well, he uses selective approaches,
calls it selective
to removing trees. But he also uses that land for a multitude of other purposes. It isn't just logging that he does.
He had his sheep, for example. He called them the brush cutters, and they would be led out at certain times of the year, particularly in the summertime, to cut down the brush, because we know that sheep will take everything, even seedlings, in the winter. So he would keep the sheep penned off in the winter. He would, for example, not cut the very the largest of the Doug firs, recognizing that, for example, squirrels would go after the best cones on the Doug fir, and the squirrels would in turn become the planters. He wouldn't engage in manual planting, but allow natural seed dispersal to take place with birds, with wind, with squirrels. He would maintain habitat for flicker populations, for helping to keep down bug populations. So his approach is multidimensional in that he tries to maintain a recognizing that it is a managed forest, but as a managed forest, he tries to learn from nature's wisdom as much as possible and then have it applied.
Now, that actually raises something that I was going to ask, is did you two coin the term ecoforestry?
I don't know if we coined it or if...
I forget.
People were using the term, and I don't think we coined the term. I think we picked it up back in the 90s, was it? Before we did the ecoforestry book.
It was in the early 90s.
Yeah, I think it was in the early 90s. And both Duncan and I traveled up and down the coast looking for examples that were like MERS. Other foresters who were doing similar kinds of more forest management, with having a forest that had the characteristics of wild forests, from which they were taking a variety of products rather than, cutting the whole thing down. So we went up and down the coast looking for people who were doing the same kinds of things that MERV was doing. And we found people all up and down the coast who were.
Yeah.
And some of those people I know, like Orville Camp.
Orville Camp in Oregon.
He was using the term ecoforestry way back then. He was also talking about being a forest farmer, because there was a Forest Farmers Association in the United States. And he was trying to communicate the kind of approach that he was using, which is basically the same approach that MERV was using, to all these people who had forests and were also doing some kind of farming,
Yeah.
But by forest farming, he didn't mean planting plantations. That's absolute taboo in, Camp's language. He has no... place in his heart for plantations, and MERV the same way.
Yes, one of the principles is that you, instead of focusing on the products, you focus on the ecological processes that lead to those products, and so you strive to maintain healthy ecological processes
and function
and
structure.
What is the definition of ecoforestry? Is there a clean, clear one?
What is what?
A definition. Definition.
Oh, well, let's see. What's that guy's name over there in who talks about holistic forestry?
Oh, Herb Hammond.
Herb Hammond. Herb Hammond prefers the word holistic forestry. Now, basically, what we mean by ecoforestry and what Merv means by holistic forestry is the same thing.
That's synonymous.
What we're talking about is ecologically responsible forest use. That's why we subtitled our book Ecoforestry, The Art and Science of Sustainable Ecological Forest Use. We wanted to use the words ecologically responsible forest use, but our publisher thought that that was too heavy duty, that sustainable, because they had a whole series of books on sustainability, you see, so it made better sense for them in their particular marketing and so on. But what, you know, in our own minds, what we're really talking about is the same sort of thing that we found all these other people talking about. And there was sort of a consensus among the people up and down the coast and other places that we corresponded with, for example, people on the East Coast who were also engaged in forest work of this sort, that the word ecoforestry seemed to be good, and it was comparable to the concept of eco-agriculture, because what both of these concepts mean is a holistic approach to managing our activities consistent with what the indigenous and the original processes can support by maintaining those kinds of functions and structures and so on. So eco-agriculture collects a whole range of practices that we would say are ecologically responsible, all the way from permaculture to organic gardening, for example. And ecoforestry is a similar kind of concept. We saw it at a certain stage of our development in this whole process, going back to the early 90s to today, as a kind of transition concept or transition term. We saw ecoforestry as a work in progress, so to speak. So what we did in our first book on ecoforestry was to try to capture all the major topics of the whole range, and that as a result, we have, you know, quite a range of articles. We have glossary. We have extensive bibliography, lists of people to get in touch with, organizations, so on. All the issues of certification and so on. But now in this book, Wild Foresting, we're going beyond that. And we assume ecoforestry and its continuing role. But now, because of the critical state of the planet and global warming and other major destruction of biodiversity and cultural diversity and linguistic diversity and so on, we see it as critically important to preserve and maintain wild forest ecosystems. At the same time, we have to have responsible use of them, because people can't live without using wild forests. But we also envisage the restoration of wild forests, addressing the nature deficit in children's education in our advanced industrial societies, in restoration work, and so on. So this new book, takes ecoforestry as a kind of context that's changing and evolving, but at the same time adds these other dimensions to it.
How do you restore wild forests? Like, you can actually do that? How does...
Yeah, I think... restoration of wild ecosystems is going on all the time. I mean, it's a natural process for one thing. You know, you have a large area and you have major disturbances taking place as a result of natural disturbances, and those processes are taking place there. And there are groups around the world who are doing the same kind of thing, for instance, restoring forests in Scotland, restoring mangrove forests in Thailand and so on.
In Australia.
And Australia. So, and we have, see, there's ecological restoration and then there's restoration ecology. And one of these is a discipline, scientific study, interdisciplinary and so on, and the other's on the ground activity.
Now, can you explain the concept of wild foresting? I know, I'm asking the tough ones. You've got a whole book that's within the concept of wild foresting. But...
Yeah.
Alan and I were talking about this prior to you coming here. Wild foresting, we're using foresting as a verb rather than as a noun. Ecoforestry is a noun. Wild foresting is a verb. It relates to a process. It relates to a systemic way of looking at the world, that there is no radical separation between the person and the forest. Between, you know, you're not looking at a forest just as a series of objects out there, a commodity. It's no longer a commodity. It's much, instead of an I-it relationship, it becomes much more of an I-thou relationship. It's a way of being. It's a way of being that, one level, it recognizes that we are inextricably linked with the health of the forest ecosystems, and our health is linked with that. It recognizes that we need to, for a very long time, forestry has been engaged in making the ecosystem change its requirements to meet the needs of an ever-expanding economy. Now we have to flip that around 180 degrees and make the economy a subsystem to the imperatives of the ecosystems. It recognizes no separation, again, between living sentient beings and ourselves and the larger ecosystem. And so it's a way of being, it's a way of living, it's a way of thinking. It's a recognition that the so-called environmental crisis isn't a crisis so much out there as a crisis in our values, in our way we think, in our mindset. And the mindset that we have profoundly affects the landscape, the mental topography, the physical topography, and there's a profound interrelationship. And we want to get that idea across in the very nature of the term eco, or wild foresting.
Well, it's fascinating. Yeah, and blend the scientific and the spiritual.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
See, in the first book, the art and science, and now wild foresting takes a step further and brings the spiritual into the equation. We had a subtitle of an article we wrote on environmental ethics, and it was seeing trees and not forests, remember? And the trees had a S with a dollar sign. Seeing the trees and not the forest.
That's
what
right.
was it? The summers, it was
yeah, a, it was a chapter for a textbook that's
on environmental ethics, and they wanted a section on forest values. And we were making the distinction between the fragmented atomistic reductionist account that just values tree stems, and in terms of a market value. So you just have two-dimensional values here, quantitative values. Whereas a forest has complex system of values, we were able to determine at least 7 major categories of values in total forest system, you see. But you get, an individual tree, of course, can symbolize the entire world. It symbolizes in many spiritual traditions all the dimensions of reality, physical and otherwise. So individual trees, of course, come out of forests. You don't first have individual trees and then forests. Forests and individual trees are part of a dynamic, evolutionary, interrelated process. And in a wild foresting approach, we want to emphasize that even in a city, you could have a municipal forest that provides opportunities for wild foresting activities. It might be, gathering nuts. It might be just going out and sitting in the forest and contemplating. It might, in Japan, they have this whole thing called air breathing. They've found out that going out in the forest completely changes the way a person feels about themselves and the world around them. And so now they even have this concept in Japan as a type of therapy.
And this leads into one of the parts of our book, where we're talking about the role of forests for health, for example, children. And increasing evidence is now coming out, particularly a lot of the work being done at the University of Illinois on what's referred to as nature deficit disorder, that children who are exposed to unstructured playtime in wild areas have much lower levels of ADD or ADHD.
And other disorders, too.
And other disorders, too.
I mean, physical disorders.
Children who go into the woods and engage in, you know, climbing trees and what is sometimes referred to as risky behavior has been shown in studies in Britain now that they have much higher immune systems later in life.
Much higher, better functioning.
They are also able to engage in terms of the life challenges much better in terms of having a sense of inner resilience.
Now, one of the original studies done on this in North America was done by Edith Cobb, and she called her study The Ecology of Imagination in Childhood. And she did a study of a whole bunch of people who were, you know, exceptional people that a lot of people thought of them as almost like they were geniuses and so on. They were very creative and they were very resilient and they contributed a lot. And so she did this study in which she tried to see what the common background and elements in their childhood was that led them to be so unusual and so creative. And that's what the main thing that she found throughout their childhood was this same pattern of deep connection with natural places where they were allowed freedom to play.
With the new book, are you hoping to reach civilians or politicians or...
I would say all of the above. The book is done in such a way that it is accessible to the general public, but it can certainly go to to policymakers, to educators. We also wanted to have a book that gave a profound level of hope. Each of the articles that are in that book represents a case study that shows what people at the grassroots are doing in communities all over the world to actually regenerate communities with forest ecosystems. There's the idea that we start out with, for example, in the book, when the world, in terms of, and one of the areas that I get research and I teach is complex systems, that when systems become highly unstable, it's at that very time that a small group of people, as it were, sort of a la the butterfly effect, can push the trajectory very easily into one direction or another. And what we see, not only all around the world, you now have examples of communities and individuals engaged now in increasing, forest ecosystem health, community health. There are examples of this.
And fisheries, examples of all kinds of fisheries related to changing ecosystem health, related forests, treating human sewage, for example, by means of restoration of marshes and forests and things of that sort.
These can act as tipping points, as it were, in highly unstable economic times and climate uncertainty. Areas of this sort can act as tipping points, which can turn what were vicious cycles into virtuous cycles.
What can an individual do? What can I do? What can somebody listening to this do to improve the world, to improve the situation for us? And
recognize that at times of crisis and instability, it's also a profound opportunity for hope and transformation. That again, when ecosystems, when social systems are highly unstable, that is potentially a very empowering time for individuals and groups. It's also a recognition that we need to change our priorities. We've been looking for, you know, satisfaction, for happiness, perhaps in all the wrong places. And it's we need to recognize that. I was down at a conference not long ago in Sydney, Australia, and the whole conference was dedicated to life satisfaction and human happiness. And one of the things that I think intuitively we've known for some time is that once basic human needs are met, increasing incomes can be indeed a detriment to life satisfaction and human happiness. Community, wild places, friendships, generosity, appreciation of the aesthetics, all contribute to profound life satisfaction. Wild places, wild forests.
If the premier picks up your book tomorrow and goes, hey, these guys know what's going on, I'm putting you two in charge of forest policy, what would you do? How would you run our forests?
That's a good question. I was still thinking about the last question. because I wanted to say that there's a multitude of things that individuals can do, and we have to be careful not to say everybody has to do exactly the same thing. Yeah. There are vast opportunities for creative action on many levels, and so we're going to discover, as we move away from fossil fuels as a basis for energy systems, that there's a multitude of solutions out there, especially on the small scale local level, which together add up to vast amounts more than our gigawatt plants, and using coal and so on, than those kind of systems. So part of the re-education of our politicians and managers and so on is to stop thinking in terms of mega projects and large scale, single theme kinds of projects, and start thinking in terms of the capacity of our individuals to create a wide range of practices at the local level. So with respect to our forests have been mismanaged because, that is from an ecological standpoint, because they have been put under a single model that is a plantation model of industrial forestry. So the idea is to cut down all of the old trees, which are decadent and old and so on, replace them with superior genetically modified plantations. Yeah. And the whole idea is to have a continuous stream of material throughput in order to generate a high level of economic activity. But one of the things that people overlook about this is that the whole thing is actually, like the financial system, driven by debt, you see. Part of the debt is ecological debt. Part of the debt is local community debt. When I was a boy, we had a lot of vibrant local rural communities in British Columbia and Washington, Alaska, and so on. And a lot of those are gone now. Same with agriculture in the prairies. When I was a boy living on the prairies, we had all of these small agricultural communities, but they were based on a complex mixed farm system, family farms, 160 acres or 320 acres or whatever, and they were doing lots of different things on these farms. They weren't eco-side type farms, you see. And in principle, those farms could have been sustained with their cultural complexity indefinitely. But what destroyed them? Well, it was the financial system. It was the farm policies. There were all kinds of things that were part of this. We're in that situation today where we're seeing a destruction of this cultural diversity and local communities all over in British Columbia because of what's happened in forestry. And I can't remember a time when our forestry sector wasn't in crisis. Can you?
No.
It's always in crisis.
Yeah.
And it's because of this whole mindset, you see, this large scale, single use, single through large throughput, so on, approach.
Yeah. I mean, you could go and say, in British Columbia, we need a profound overhaul of the tenure system of this province.
Exactly.
Right now. We also need to be able to allow communities and the diverse nature of communities to be able to have a much greater say on what takes place in the watersheds of their regions. And I would say that some of the examples coming out now, you have, for example, in parts of Alberta, what's referred to as the genuine wealth indicator model. How can a community actually determine what does it really need in terms of genuine wealth? And genuine wealth goes far beyond economic wealth. It refers to the wealth of the community, the wild places, friendships, a sense of children being able to play safely, and so on and so forth. And when communities can really be able to monitor what it means to have genuine wealth, then you start seeing very quickly, that, hey, this leads right into what we're talking about in terms of wild foresting.
And there's a whole system for analyzing and measuring and qualifying GPI,
genuine progress indicators.
Which
is a type of genuine
wealth. We have website references to those. There's books and articles, and people have been doing the on-the-ground work. So, it isn't it's sort of airy, purely research-oriented stuff. It's being practically employed, and it's an alternative to using GDP, gross domestic product, as the sole measure of economic well-being. Look how we've talked ourselves into recession and terrible economic downturn as a result of what happened in financial system, as a result of basically gambling. These guys with the hedge funds, and all of these different elements that they introduced without any kind of oversight or regulation, was basically large-scale global gambling with financial systems. And what's the end result, you see? So it's clear that, we need quite different approaches to managing things, and we need to include a wide variety of approaches, not single-use type approach. And that's what we see. Ecoforestry is a very complex, multi-value, multidisciplinary, multi-generational approach to forest use. And we see wild foresting as another sort of dimension to that, but it includes an appreciation for the state of wild forest today, how we can get more wild forest back into access for local people in cities and that kind of thing. If you go to visit, say, Oslo, one of the things you'll note is that Oslo has thousands of acres of municipal forest surrounding the city, with all kinds of corridors going down through the city to the fjord. And anybody in Oslo has almost immediate access to what they call free nature. Free nature is more like our concept of wilderness or wild nature, you see. But I can have wild nature in my backyard. I do have wild nature in my backyard. I have little creatures coming in here all the time who are wild, and I can appreciate them. And if I have a connection with local forest ecosystems and wilderness places or wild places or free nature places, then I can have even sort of a mini, you see. And the more of this sort of thing we have, the better.
Well, I've only got one more question for you. But so one question for that. What are the trees in your backyard?
What are the trees in
What are all the trees in your backyard? Because you do have a real mix.
The biggest tree out there is a Gary Oak. They go all the way from California up to just south of Nanaimo. That particular tree is about 350 years old at least. They are very drought resistant. This is an area that's relatively, has characterized by periods of drought. And so we only have about 22 inches of rain a year here because we're in rain shadow. this whole area was once covered mostly with those big Gary oaks. And then in areas that a little bit better drained, there would be Doug fir. So okay. This is called Gary Oak Doug fir Savanna. And that tree there is a cedar. And this tree right here is a Macintosh apple. That tree behind it that's getting yellow, there's two plum trees there. Several of those fruit trees we planted since we moved here 20 years ago.
Okay. How do you feel about trees?
I love trees. They are not... they are friends. They are teachers. Yeah. I have profound respect for trees, and they are teachers.
Well, my feelings about trees are incredibly complex because they are sort of nurtured and informed by my Norse shamanic background. It's part of the central mythology of the North. For the conception of the world reality. As you know, this same concept of the tree, you know, with its roots and its branches and everything representing all the different levels of reality from physical to the spiritual and the afterlife too, is found in cultures the world over. Trees symbolizing classification systems and the branching of classifications. So there's all these philosophical, scientific, and so on. But then at another level, there's my deep personal feeling for trees and the way that I have felt special bond with individual trees and also with various stands of forest that I've traveled through in my journeys as a climber and also as a journeyer in the old Norse tradition. You know, the word a Viking was originally a verb which meant journeying spiritually, shamanically, in the world, you know, out on the ocean, in the forests. And that's my heritage, is that wide journeying. And trees are always part of that, making things out of trees, building cabins, building forests, making tree houses. So my whole life has been informed by trees, and today and every day I try to go out walking in the forests around here, and a lot of times I'm all by myself, and I have various...
Well, you've got a dog.
And sometimes, yeah, my dog, of course, is always looking for things. bonding with those trees and receiving a certain kind of communication from the trees. So that's, you know, it's just endless in complexity and quality and beauty and all of those things.
Cool. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for your interest.
Thanks for checking out the Green Chain Podcast. For more on the future of our forests, be sure to look for my book, The Green Chain, Nothing is Ever Clear Cut. I'm Mark Learn Young.